On February 6, 2012, Chinese police surrounded the U.S. consulate in Chengdu, China, in a tense 30-hour standoff. Inside, Wang Lijun frantically pled for asylum as he presented evidence of what would become the nation's biggest scandal in decades. As police chief of the country's third-largest city, Wang possessed documents, he said, which could bring down his boss and one of the most powerful men in China, Bo Xilai. It all revolved around a British businessman named Neil Haywood. In exchange for getting Bo's son into a prestigious boarding school, Haywood was rewarded with political favors. But for reasons that are still unclear, Bo's wife grew frustrated and eventually poisoned the man. Dramatic, Oscar-worthy stories like this one are a dime a dozen in China. In 2019, for example, this video circulated on social media, showing 13.5 tons of gold hidden in a party secretary's home. Between 2012 and 17 alone, 1.5 million officials were disciplined for corruption. That's nearly 700 criminal charges, demotions, and dismissals every single day for 6 straight years. It should be no surprise, then, that China has, quote, serious corruption problems, according to Transparency International. But here's what is surprising. Take each country and place it on a line from most to least corrupt. Now, on the x-axis, show its economic growth. What emerges is the general trend you'd expect. The less corruption, the stronger an economy. Corruption, after all, is a tax on business. It scares away investors and diverts limited resources towards unproductive roads to nowhere. And yet, China is way over here, with both extremely high growth and corruption. How is that possible? How has China defied predictions of imminent economic collapse every single year for decades? Not by eliminating corruption, but by doing what no other country has managed to do so effectively, weaponizing it. Sponsored by CuriosityStream and Nebula, where you can watch my brand new Nebula original series. This first full-length episode is about how Chinese censorship actually works and why the regime does sometimes tolerate dissent. Watch it with the CuriosityStream and Nebula bundle, right now 42% off for Mother's Day, just $12 a year. If you enjoy these videos, sign up to get 50% more of them starting today. On the very first day of Finance 101, students are taught about the principal-agent problem. Capitalism, it goes, is all about specialization. It isn't efficient, or even possible, for each of us to sew our own clothes, solder our own electronics, and be our own doctors. So, we outsource each of these jobs to someone more qualified. Modern life, in other words, requires delegation. But how do a company's shareholders ensure its managers, who they delegate decision-making to, don't misuse their money? Replace shareholders with voters and managers with politicians, and you understand why eliminating corruption is a really hard problem. That's in a democracy. But even the most iron-fisted dictator can't possibly make, much less implement, every last decision on their own. They too must delegate. Say you're the leader of China. Whether or not you have the people's best interest in mind, you also know your legitimacy, and therefore your power, depends on some level of competence. While nationalism and censorship afford the Communist Party plenty of room for failure, at the end of the day, your continued rule requires food on the table, gas in the tank, and at least some occasional clean water. On a purely organizational level, take a second to appreciate just how hard a coordination problem it is to convert words at the top into the actions 99 layers below, which result in more high-speed rail than every other country put together, and maintain 10% GDP growth for years on end. Now, for the sake of simplicity, let's condense those hypothetical 99 layers into just 3. At the very top of the pyramid are a tiny number of elite party officials. Getting them to follow orders is relatively easy. Their next promotion depends on it. The problem lies between them and the public. the ground-level civil servants who, on any given day, actually deliver the functions of government, providing healthcare, delivering education, and building infrastructure. Unlike the elites, these officials are usually stationed in one city for their entire careers. They aren't playing some house of cards game of political intrigue, they're just looking to put food on the table. And hey, if they can convert what authority they have into a new car or apartment, even better. And therein lies the problem. The Chinese bureaucracy is huge. We're talking 50 million party state employees, aka all of South Korea, or Texas and New York put together. That's excluding its military, the world's largest, and state-owned enterprises, which comprise 9 of the country's 10 largest employers. Plus, that number is from 2007. Meanwhile, thanks to outdated rules and widespread evasion, only 2% of the population paid any income tax in 2015, according to one former official. In other words, there just isn't enough revenue to go around. Public servants are paid peanuts. The average nationwide monthly wage is $1,298. Yet the highest paid civil servants make just $824, and the lowest a measly $80. This is a dangerous combination. Lots of local political power, yet thanks to desperation, every incentive to hinder and steal rather than help the country. How do you convince these local officials, who may not even make a living wage, to stop harassing businesses, which you, the leader, need to create the jobs and drive the economic growth that keeps you in power? Countries unable to answer this question end up like the Philippines, paralyzed against their will by an endless cycle of incompetence and corruption. One obvious solution is to do as Singapore does, pay them so much that they don't have to resort to bribery. Members of its parliament are given a monthly allowance 3 times higher than the median household income, and its prime minister is the world's highest paid political leader, earning 4 times as much as the US president. The results are compelling. No politician has been charged with corruption in 2 decades, and the country is tied for 2nd place on the Corruption Perception Index. But, of course, this is easier said than done. High public salaries are a luxury most of the world simply can't afford. It's no coincidence that the countries at the top of the list are also the world's wealthiest. Of the top 10, for example, the poorest is New Zealand, with a per capita GDP of $41,000. China, on the other hand, discovered a much cheaper solution. One invisible to the Corruption Perception Index, which lumps 6 different things together under this nebulous umbrella term. More interesting than how much corruption is what kind. Yunyung Ang, in her book China's Gilded Age, argues there are actually 4 distinct types. When the rich world hears the word corruption, we imagine the 1% of the 1%, presidents, prime ministers, and oligarchs, colluding in poorly lit rooms to siphon off public funds for personal gain. Yachts, mansions, and private jets. That's grand theft. Conversely, people from lower income regions may not have to imagine. They can simply remember a cop soliciting bribes. This is known as petty theft. Whether small or large, theft is bad for everyone but the thief. When your leader embezzles public funds to buy rare leopard skin hats, you receive nothing. But there's another dimension, exchanges, transactions in which the buyer receives special treatment. If you need 20 permits to open a restaurant, you almost have to pay what's called speed money to overcome the red tape. This is better than mere theft because at least you get something in return. You're not worse off after paying the bribe. Still, you're certainly not celebrating. But then there's something called access money, exchanges that make both parties much better off. Now, make no mistake, all corruption is bad. But bad to who, when, and how? If you're a business, the theft kind is just a loss, what economists would call a tax. Access money, on the other hand, is actually an investment. Suddenly you're able to buy certain privileges that you previously couldn't. And this kind is precisely what China has the most of. Here's how it works. At the top of each regional government, remember, is a powerful elite, whose performance is evaluated based on objective metrics like economic growth. The problem? His or her next promotion requires the cooperation of hundreds or thousands of poorly paid subordinates. What motivation does the bureaucrat making $80 a month have to play along? So the two reach an agreement. Help me climb the ladder and I'll make sure you're well taken care of. Government departments are allowed to operate almost like independent businesses, keeping some portion of whatever they collect in fees and taxes. Some of this money, in turn, is used to shower workers with perks that would make even a Google employee jealous. Everything from food to vacations, parties, housing, electricity, gas, childcare, furniture, and equipment. Although public wages are set below market rates, formal salaries only comprise 24% of the average bureaucrat's total compensation. When these unofficial benefits are included, you can see they're actually doing quite well. Bureaucrats may be short on cash, but that doesn't mean you won't spot them on the golf course or beach sipping champagne. But don't lose the forest for the trees. The point is not that government workers are well paid. It's that they receive a kind of unofficial commission. Every last cadre, no matter how low on the org chart, has a personal stake in the country's development. Does your office need new computers? Is your family due for a tropical vacation? Chinese bureaucrats can and do extort businesses for a few quick bucks, but the big money is in attracting businesses, from whom most taxes are generated. Local governments ferociously compete to be Tesla, IKEA, and Walmart's best friend. One province, for instance, introduced leave business alone days, during which inspections and other regulatory intrusions were banned. Another county's slogan is, quote, "Investors are gods, bureaucrats are humble servants, and those who harm corporate interests are sinners." The genius of the Chinese system is that it found an innovative way to harness corruption for the greater good. Paradoxically, this incredible economic growth was made possible by millions of officials using public funds to play blackjack in Macau and buy designer handbags in Paris. We think of the Chinese central government as all-powerful and all-encompassing, able to wield its authority far and wide. But there remain practical and physical limits to what's possible. Eliminating corruption is hard, if not impossible, on a budget. So instead, China carefully manages which kind is tolerated. As you can clearly see, non-transactional theft has been systematically targeted, while business-friendly favors are left alone. Likewise, just as bureaucrats are managed by an imperfect combination of carrot and stick, so too are individual citizens. Chinese censorship is highly coercive, technologically advanced, and effective. But it's not perfect. And surprisingly, nor is it absolute. Authoritarian governments like China's are a giant black box, shrouded in doubt and secrecy. But understanding what it does and doesn't censor is a rare and revealing reflection of how the Communist Party thinks and what it fears most. This video has been about how China controls its cadres. This full-length 15-minute Nebula original about how China controls its people is the very first episode in my new series explaining how the country actually works, starting by looking underneath the black bar of censorship. What gets censored, and even more interesting, what doesn't, and why? The team and I have been working overtime to bring you an additional Nebula-exclusive video for every other one you see on YouTube. These are full-length, normal Polymatter videos, not bonus, extended, or director's cuts. In other words, you can start getting 50% more Polymatter for just $12 a year right now for Mother's Day by signing up to the CuriosityStream and Nebula bundle. On top of that, you'll get access to dozens of Nebula originals and exclusives, not to mention ad-free videos from your favorite creators. On CuriosityStream, you'll find great feature-length documentaries, like this one, about a Japanese family who rents fake friends and spouses for social events. Click the link on screen right now to get both Nebula and CuriosityStream for an amazing $15 a year, and go watch the companion video over on Nebula.